There have been a lot of ups and downs in the local news this week. There was encouraging news that the Museum of Innovation and Science, or MISci, in Schenectady will not have to move after all, with its future preserved there for at least another 5 years. On the other side, Sunday's Amber Alert, followed by the tragic news that the infant involved died and her mother had been charged with murder, that one's not the sort of story that we wanted to see in the headlines. But then again, on the upside, there was perhaps the most viral story, at least among the collegiate crowd here in Albany. I'm talking about the random appearance of late-night TV talk show host Jimmy Fallon on Saturday morning during Kegs and Eggs in Albany's Pine Hills neighborhood. The Tonight Show host, who's also a St. Rose grad, was in town to open for comedian Nate Bargatze that night at the MVP Center.
I woke up, I was in Albany, and that's where I went to college. So I went to visit the College of St. Rose, I went to my old college, I went to my old apartment.
Ooh.
And rang the doorbell. Two kids came down, and I go, hey, what's up, man? And they're like, can we help you? And I'm like, no, I used to live here. And they're like, are you Jimmy? And I go, yeah. They go, what's going on, dude? They thought they were getting punked or something. I don't know. Took a picture with those guys. Then I crashed a frat party.
Oh, yeah.
You can see some of the videos that were taken of Fallon's surprise appearance on Hudson Ave at timesunion.com. All right, let's go across the river now to Rensselaer County, where, as Christy Gustafson-Barletti says, a surprising number of people confess they don't want to go. She joins me now to talk about why there's this stigma about crossing the Hudson. I love your headline. It's, you know, really eye-catching. Why are we afraid or annoyed to cross the Hudson in the Capital Region? Before we get to the answer to that question, I kind of was hoping that you would kind of describe the geography a little bit for people who don't know it, you know, maybe who haven't been there or who don't quite understand, you know, what you're talking about when we're crossing the Hudson.
All right. So if you think of the Capital Region, most people consider just four counties. They consider Saratoga, Schenectady, Albany, and Rensselaer County. And the first three are all to the west of the Hudson River, and Rensselaer County sits solely to the east of the Hudson River. Now, I'm not factoring in Columbia County and Montgomery County and other counties that are certainly important to the Capital Region, but aren't really at the core of what we would kind of consider the 518, so to speak.
Yeah, and they're not the people who are crossing the Hudson or who are likely to cross the Hudson.
Right.
They're farther out.
So where people are crossing the river to get from Albany County to Rensselaer County, it's only about a quarter of a mile wide, the Patroon Island Bridge, the Dunmore Memorial Bridge, or any of the bridges. Yet people look at it as if they're going to another country instead of another county. And that baffles me because I grew up in Rensselaer County and I just find that insane.
So I used to work in Rensselaer County and I've never had a problem going over there. I've never really felt whatever this fear or stigma is. So like, where is it coming from? What is it?
I think it's really the unknown. Look, there used to be a reporter at the Times Union. This reporter was like standout, one of the best writers that we had. But this person did not want to cover stories if he or she had to go across the Patroon Island Bridge because there was almost this ideology that there's nothing worth it over there or there's nothing that needs to be checked out. Now, obviously, this person had really good news judgment and would recognize if there was like a breaking news story or something that you go. But generally speaking, the idea for many people is I can find anything I need west of the river, so there's no need for me to go east of the river, which I just find crazy. And my parents live in Averill Park and will sell things on Marketplace. And as soon as people hear that they're in Rensselaer County, they're like, oh no, I can't go there. But if my parents offered to meet them right on the other side, so say in Albany County around like where Memorial Hospital is and Madison Cafe and Risotto right there. So right on the other side of the Patroon Island Bridge, people are like, okay, sure. Yeah, I'll do that. So there's just something about the idea of coming to Rensselaer County that intimidates people. I think, look, as humans, right, we're sometimes a little uncertain of the unknown. And for whatever reason, Rensselaer County is more unknown to people than, say, Schenectady County or Saratoga County. So to me, it's weird. And I mean, I grew up there, so I don't find the intimidation logical, but I get it and I hear it all the time. This story ran about 10 days ago now, and people have come up to me still and want to talk to me about it and say, oh my gosh, that's me. I relate, and I can't tell you why, but I just don't want to go.
Again, it baffles me too. I don't live over there, but it does baffle me. But could it also be something like, you know, superstition of crossing over water, or like the political divide? Because, you know, over on sort of the eastern side of the Hudson, Rensselaer County tends to skew one way politically, whereas Albany on the other side tends to skew another way. Like, is there any of that that people communicated?
Some people did talk in the comments about the politics, but more it was people who lived there and said, oh, come on over because my side of the river has the right kind of views. More so than that, I don't know if it would be a fear of crossing the river, because if you think about it, you go up the Twin Bridges and you're crossing a river, right? There's,
yeah,
it's not the Hudson River, it's the Mohawk River, but there's other places in the capital region to cross a body of water. So, right, if somebody said, I don't like bridges and don't want to cross a body of water, I'd give that to you because I don't have that fear, but I certainly understand that fear. But when it's limited toward one county versus another, mm-hmm. to me, that seems crazy.
So you mentioned the views, right? So you and I did a piece last week, I believe, where we went to a Stewart's to taste the chicken waffle sandwich, which was delicious. And you gave it your blessing. But that was in Rensselaer County. And the way to get there from Albany, which is where I was coming from, has one of the greatest views, I think, in the capital region. So when you're driving toward this Stewart's that we went to in Rensselaer County, and if you look behind you, or if you're driving the other direction from the Stewart's, the view of Albany is just, it's unparalleled. It's like a really great view. So I don't know what the view thing is all about.
Well, yeah, people will come over. So there's a business that's now a dentist, but it used to be a Bennigan's. And people remember Bennigan's restaurant. Mm-hmm. They had delicious pretzel buns. But they had this great patio with this view, and people would clamor there at basically happy hour / dinner sunset time because it had such a beautiful view. Mm-hmm. And then the same thing, that whole kind of area of Route 4, which essentially lines up with downtown Albany. So on the east side of the river, you've got like a Hewitt's Garden Center and a Home Depot and a FedEx Center and a Target and all of that. They have to put signs up on July 4th to say, don't park here, no stopping, no standing, because the view is so spectacular of downtown Albany. I've been in businesses and doctor's offices and things like that that have a photo of downtown Albany taken from Rensselaer County because the view is so incredibly spectacular. But if people aren't going to go to Rensselaer County, they're never going to see that spectacular view.
That, you know, is a pretty powerful case for me because I love a good view. One of the things that you mention in both the newsletter and the article up on timesunion.com is that you talk to realtors, right? And realtors kind of have a unique perspective on this particular issue, right? Because they're, you know, working with clients and they say, hey, let's look across the river in Rensselaer County. And they run into that same kind of like hesitance, right? What did the realtors say about that?
Yes. Irene Colbita, who works with Vera Cohen, and Vera Cohen Realty is in East Green Bus. She was one of my favorite interviews in the story because I thought she just really nailed it. She said, look, I'm originally from Niskayuna and I used to have the same view. Oh, I don't need to go over there. But then I started working over there. And then she said she will talk to clients who are currently living in Rensselaer County and they are open to the idea of essentially buying a home in any county. It's more about the city than the actual county. They'll say, sure, Albany County, sure, Schenectady, sure, Saratoga. But when she has people in those three counties, she often has to do some convincing and tell people about, say, the great school districts or the value, the property value or taxes or things like that. And then when she's able to talk to them and present them with, say, hard numbers or facts, they will consider Rensselaer County. But it's not just a, oh, sure, right off the bat, like it may be for people going the other direction. So, and realtors even commented on my posts on social media and said they experienced the same thing with their clients. Not if they're out of the area, out of the state, because then you don't really know. It's really if people who are local and are continuing to stay local and just move within the region.
Mm-hmm. And of course, housing prices tend to be lower on the eastern side of the river, right?
Oh my gosh, yes. We talked about that too. I mean, significantly lower. And people will get more property at a larger home where, let's say in North Greenbush versus what they may get in a Colony with a smaller piece of property and a smaller home for the same price.
Wow, that is striking. That's an interesting perspective. One more thing that I wanted to draw attention to with regard to this is Troy, right? Because Troy has experienced an explosion in popularity, both for people coming to live downtown and businesses and sort of cultural events and tech and all of the things that have really blown up Troy in the last couple of years. Like, how does Troy factor into all this?
I actually think Troy is the biggest factor. And several of the experts I spoke with for this story said the same, because look, there's the farmers market, which is unparalleled. It's one of the best, if not the best, in the capital region. They have festivals like outdoor art festivals. They just had the mural painting project that gained statewide attention. They have so many restaurants and they've made such a revitalization effort. And as a result, it is attracting people to the other side of the river. And you know what also came up quite a bit, and this is a venue you and I have visited several times for the Times Union, but so many readers brought this up and said June Farms. So Matt Baumgartner's June Farms, which is in West Sand Lake. Mm-hmm. There are people who said, oh, I never would have gone over there, but I just was so drawn to whether it was an activity that they were doing, a party that the farm was hosting, seeing the animals. So many people said that that's what got them out to Rensselaer County. And going to June Farms is way different than going to Troy, because June Farms is rural Rensselaer County. Troy is basically Albany on the other side of the river, but mm-hmm. I would say a little bit better.
Now, of course, you can watch our videos from June Farms that we've done in the past, which include, but are not limited to, a visit to their Hobbit house and a walk with their sheep, which, you know, I just was some of the most fun I've had on the job.
I know, we were lucky to do those.
To read Christy's full piece on the stigma surrounding Rensselaer County, head on over to timesunion.com. We're going to take a short break now, but when we come back, senior editor Steve Barnes and dining critic Susie Davidson Powell will join us to discuss the fine art of reading a menu. Stay tuned.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union subscriber today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Eagle, a Times Union podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Marshall. Let's go out to eat at a restaurant now. Figuratively, of course. What is the first thing that we're going to do when we're seated at the table? I'm guessing we'll pick up the menu. Our order is going to be based on what we see in what Times Union senior editor Steve Barnes says is a roadmap. If the chefs and restaurateurs have done their jobs well, the menu will tell you all that you need to know. Steve joins us now, along with dining critic Susie Davidson Powell, to talk more about the art of reading a menu.
Hey, Susie.
Hi, Steve.
It occurred to me the other week, I wrote something for the Table Hopping newsletter, that you can read a menu like a roadmap. If it's a well-crafted menu, it tells you just about everything you need to know, not only about the food, but also about the people making it, the attitude of the chef, and also the restaurant itself. Do you agree?
I do. I would go so far as to say, you know, the menu is critical to framing the identity of the restaurant or what they're trying to sort of impart. It's temporal in as much as it's probably going to have seasonal aspects to it. And its goal is to persuade you that you want to eat there and what you're going to choose from the menu.
Well, let's start with one that's really classic. The Wishing Well has been around 88 years now, up in Gansevoort, just north of Saratoga. And it's a classic old restaurant. And their menu struck me as something that is, while traditional, there's enough there for it to help you make the choices you want. And it also says something about it. So if we start at the top, Maryland crab cake. Okay, that's not enough for me to make a decision. But if you continue in that description, arugula, smoked tomato aioli, corn relish. What else does that tell you about what the chef is doing at the Wishing Well when their crab cake comes this way?
obviously there are some trends here, right? So we're all, whether it's across cocktails or small plates, smoking things seems to be quite on point at the moment. So a smoked tomato aioli, that's definitely telling us there's some creativity there in the kitchen. They're not just sort of slapping it out with a little bit of, you know, lettuce. The corn relish, you know, maybe that's seasonal, maybe it's not. I don't know if they make that in-house. But, you know, they're thinking about how they're putting it together. You know, I assume that they're using lump crab in the crab cake. So, yeah, I would say there's something there that would pique my interest.
And then jumping down a few, each of these things, okay, we've got frog legs. I mean, frog legs, they were in and then over decades and then out and then in and then out for a very long time. And, oh, we've got frog legs back. Garlic butter veal broth.
Crispy, tiny frog legs. I mean, first of all, that description is not just frog legs, right? I mean, we're really kind of emphasizing these are going to be, you know, crisp and something good to nibble on. I mean, you know, put it in the same family as chicken wings. Why not? Frog legs, just as tasty. But then having a veal broth, that also, that's interesting. This is definitely showing that you have a kitchen that's thinking creatively and sort of pushing the boat out a bit there. Definitely something different.
Let's move on to pharmacy, resto bar. Yeah. I know both of us are big fans of pharmacy.
Yeah.
I love the creativity there, but I've got to say, I hate their online menu.
Yeah, it's tricky to navigate.
I mean, it's simply set against a photo of a steak that's fairly rare sitting in some sort of salad with a puddle of dressing with a listing. But then, you know, arugula salad, oh, arugula again, cucumber, blackberry, crumbled cheddar, apple vinaigrette.
You know, I was less excited by this arugula salad. I think there are a few things that have happened over the past few years. Take the beet and goat cheese salad as a case in point. You know, that suddenly leapt onto menus, became ubiquitous everywhere. And some places are still putting it out there, you know, brand new restaurants opening and there's a beet and goat cheese salad. Nothing wrong with that. They're often delicious. But you're always looking for something that at least says we're forward thinking. And arugula is safe, but it can be divisive. I know lots of people who don't like arugula, the same way that cilantro can be divisive. And anytime I see fruit like blackberry being used, that will give me pause whether or not it's going to be too sweet. And they're using an apple vinaigrette. I mean, I haven't had this dish, but cucumber, blackberry, crumbled cheddar, apple vinaigrette. That's a lot going on. That's going in a lot of different directions. I would be cautious about the wisdom of that.
All right, let's move down a few. Dope-ass red potato with confit, garlic, and herb butter.
Well, that sounds good to me. I mean, it better be good if you're going to give it that much of a, you know, dope-ass red potato. Okay, well, confit, garlic, that's going to be delicious. Herb butter, that's going to be delicious. I mean, really here, the potato is merely a vehicle to getting garlic butter in your system.
Well, let's move on to Simone's Kitchen. It's a place in Schenectady. It's a Mediterranean kitchen. What they have for their online menu, at least, it's the automatic ordering page, which I really dislike when you don't have an actual menu to look at. Instead, you're on an ordering page. Because if you want to see what the chicken shawarma description has, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 things that you can look at, but then it cuts off in the middle of it. And then you go to it. And you only get to see 3 things and you have to click again in order to see the entire item. So I don't have the information I need. As much as I know, I'm going to love this chicken shawarma because that's, I like it anyway. This just seems like a poor way to engage. Well, how do you feel about menus, order menus like this?
Yeah, you and I share that opinion. I mean, I always think that a website for a restaurant should have its address front and center. You wouldn't believe how many times I can't find the freaking address.
Might be under contact us, but it might be all the way at the bottom.
Yes, you have to do a lot of, you know, jump through hoops to find it. But then with this, I think they are relying on their visuals and they're definitely geared towards pre-ordering, takeout, fast, very fast casual. So I agree, you know, there's a lot of information here if you want to dig into it, but they're also sort of assuming that you'll go, I think, a little bit off the pictures. But it works for them because of so many people placing pre-orders. And that was what they came up with during the pandemic. And obviously, I mean, if you've been into the one in Schenectady, it's fantastic. It is so efficient. But it would be nice if they had a menu that you could just look at in its entirety without having to sort of click through. I do agree.
Speaking of menus in their entirety, let's go on to, I picked two for the centerpiece of the column. I picked two places so I wasn't just, you know, nagging about immediate capital region ones. One in Syracuse, one equidistant the other way to Agawam or Springfield, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Eden, wood-fired cuisine, and this is the one that's in Syracuse.
Yeah.
Now, their online menu is about 12 pages long, but if you go to the dinner menu, there's like 11, 12 things total. That's it.
Yes.
And yet, it tells me everything I need, and I understand since every wine they recommend is regional to them, most of them are Finger Lakes. Beef tartare. They tell me where the beef is from. Egg yolk, shallot, parsley, water crackers.
This is a really beautiful menu. This is really well done, especially with the wine pairings. They're telling you it's obviously very farm focused. I mean, that's not the same for every restaurant, but here that is the part of their identity. And you get that right off the rip. And same thing with them calling it small plates and large plates. You know, it's up to you. Do you want to order four small plates and call that, you know, your meal with whomever you're dining with? Or do you want to sort of do the more classic appetizer and entree? But I agree, the beef tartare presented that way, it tells you everything. I mean, it's pretty classic. And then they've made their recommendation for a wine selection.
Well, let's move on to the Federal. It's a restaurant and bar in Agawam, central Massachusetts. And as it happens, I wrote this column originally a month ago, February 1st. Well, in the interim, they've gone and closed it temporarily because the owners are a restaurant group that has multiple restaurants, and they're reopening another one. And the Federal is is 22 years old, so they decided we're going to hibernate it for a little while, so we don't know when it's coming back. But I think this, for the purposes of this discussion, the menu still is useful for comparison's sake. First of all, it's more than twice as large as the one we just looked at for Eden. And then there's so much stuff. So we talked about the steak tartare. The hand-cut steak tartare at the Federal has forest mushroom conserva, so a mushroom, preserved mushroom jam type thing, red miso, creme fraiche, quail egg, house-made thick-cut potato chips. What do we think of red miso and mushroom conserva and a steak tartare?
Well, it sounds good to me, but this is not classic, is it, right? They've changed up everything a little bit. And, you know, you could say the same about the next item, about the seared slab of foie gras à la mode. They're playing with language a lot. They're playing with ingredients a lot. I mean, even their risotto balls are called a bucket of balls. I mean, they're definitely sort of trying to pull you in. And as we said, with identity, this is showing you that this is kind of a, you know, a young, innovative, on-trend approach to some classic things. Nothing here is especially cheap, but neither is it obnoxiously expensive. So I think that steak tartare, for someone who might be saying, oh, that's a classic, you know, this is going to give you a different, very different flavor profile. And why not try that?
What we've just done is actively read a menu. You know, a guy I knew who was a real business whiz said, you give me 5 minutes with a balance sheet and I can tell you just about everything I need to know about the health of that business. The clarity, I think, that veteran readers of menus have comes from them understanding the way things work together and what's the difference between three ingredients versus six or mm-hmm. entirely complementary things or seemingly clangorous combinations. And so one of the things that I really would advocate for people, customers to do is to really look at a menu. Mm-hmm. And if needed, you know, ask about it, because one of the things that struck me when I was poking around for examples was that Salt and Char, which admittedly is a steakhouse, but Salt and Char in Saratoga simply has like salmon, $45, scallops, $49. It's literally just the name of the fish. The steaks, you know, we can learn all we want about the steaks and the sides and everything, but the fish is just, boom, here's the name of the fish. And I thought, that's not helpful.
Customers these days are much more involved in what they want to eat and whether or not they have dietary restrictions and what the ingredients are. And the same goes for cocktails, right? They're interested. I definitely remember a time when a cocktail menu just said the name of the cocktail And it didn't give a breakdown of all of the different, you know, vegetal infusions or anything else they were adding to it. I mean, this is indicative of a point in time. And I suppose in that way, you know, menus are, you know, a time capsule. It captures where we are in this moment in time. And perhaps even since, you know, the pandemic, when we went to, you know, a lot of QR codes, people still wanted to have physical menus. I mean, they're back with full force, right? And for me and for you, I think, you know, we read a menu and we get a pretty good understanding of, you know, what they're doing and perhaps if they're overreaching and perhaps if they're over-stylizing or if they're really keeping it beautifully simple. So I agree. I think people should, to the extent that they're interested, try and read a menu in advance. I usually, if I've made a restaurant reservation, I find that I then copy the link to the menu and send it around to whomever's coming with me. But I also get frustrated if a restaurant doesn't have even a sample menu on their website. It gives you clues to the formality. And, you know, is this going to be a white tablecloth establishment with, you know, servers coming around and refreshing your water? Is it more casual? You know, do the gallery photos give you a sense that it's sort of all hands on deck and bring your friends and share a bunch of small plates? You know, we want to know that in advance. And I think the menu is really the clue to that.
You can read Steve Barnes' full column on how to read a menu at timesunion.com. And you can also see Susie Davidson Powell's review of Simone Kitchen in Schenectady there as well. And be sure to subscribe to the Table Hopping newsletter. You'll get food news and reviews delivered weekly directly in your inbox. It is free, so sign up at timesunion.com/newsletters/table-hopping. And as always, you can read more about all of the stories and issues that we discuss on this podcast on our website or catch us on any of our social channels. That's Facebook, Threads, Instagram, and YouTube. Okay, that's it for this week. We'll be back next week, as always, with more from inside the newsroom. The Eagle is a production of the Times Union. It's produced and edited by myself, Jessica Marshall, with help from the Times Union digital team and the newsroom. Special thanks this week to Christy Gustafson-Barletti, Steve Barnes, and Susie Davidson-Powell for their contributions to this episode.